This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is the Woman's Hour podcast. Hello, good morning. If you haven't caught up with the programme recently, then a very happy new year, at least from me. It's not too late to say that, is it? Today on the programme, mindfulness and parenthood. If you know about mindfulness, you might be using it right now to cope with the challenges of parenthood. If you are, you can let us know about it on social media at BBC Woman's Hour. That's Twitter and Instagram. And back in 2018, three listeners told us how they felt about being fat. This week, we hear from them again. Things have changed. Their thoughts are rather different. And you'll hear from our first listener. We called her Jules, and she'll be on the programme live this morning. She's with me right now. First, we go to America, and Harvey Weinstein's rape trial begins in New York today, 2 years after the first allegations against him were made public. He's a Hollywood film producer, of course. He's 67, and he faces 5 charges of rape and sexual assault involving 2 women. He is pleading not guilty. Dozens of other women, including Gwyneth Paltrow and Angelina Jolie, have made allegations of sexual misconduct and harassment against him since the publication of revelations in the New York Times in the October of 2017. He denies any non-consensual sexual activity. Amanda Taub is a writer for the New York Times. Amanda, this seems to have taken a very, very long time, but here we are. The trial starts today.
Yes, I think depending on how you're counting, it's taken a couple of years or a couple of decades. But the trial begins today. They're starting jury selection in New York in a few hours.
Jury selection could go on for quite some time, we should say.
It's expected to go on for a couple of weeks. They have put out a call for they've sent summonses to about 1,000 people and are expecting 500 to show up and then be winnowed down from there.
So you need people to sit on this jury who have no, who are prepared to put aside, shall we say, any knowledge or preconceptions about the person in the dock.
They have to be able to promise that they will decide the case based on the evidence presented, not based on other information or preconceptions. I think it always seems like it's going to be particularly difficult in a high-profile case like this one, but this is actually what we ask jurors to do in every criminal trial. Everyone has preconceptions about murderers and drug dealers and any sort of crime that goes on trial. But I think sexual assault is always particularly difficult because it's something that has touched so many people's lives in one way or another.
Well, let's talk about this trial and the charges he faces specifically right now. What are they?
So he is accused of sexually assaulting 2 women. Obviously, many more women have made accusations against him. But in terms of these criminal trial charges, they only involve 2 accusers. One woman is a former production assistant who is alleging forcible oral sexual rape. And the other is a woman who until now has remained anonymous, so the details of her accusations are not yet known. And then there's another charge of sexual predation, which is about having a pattern of sexual abuse and criminal activity. And that could actually carry a particularly high sentence that could lead to a life sentence if he's convicted of that.
So that is the worst case scenario for Harvey Weinstein, a life sentence?
Yes.
He is 67, as I say, and the last time he appeared in court, he was using a walking support, a walking frame. What's happened to him?
That's unclear. I think he is, you know, apparently needs assistance while walking. He has been in the press lately talking about, in his view, the unreasonableness of these charges and that he feels that his, you know, career has been forgotten. And I think it seems that in many ways he feels that he is now diminished.
Yeah, he has made, well, you could call it, I suppose, a spirited defence of his cinematic legacy. He's made the point that, and this is, you can't argue against this, these are facts, that he made films about women, centering women, featuring women.
He has, and he did, but it's a little bit unclear what difference he expects that to make to these criminal charges. There isn't any amount of supporting women in the arts that gives you the legal entitlement to do the things that he's accused of.
So the significance of the trial today is what exactly?
I think the broader significance is that Harvey Weinstein has become a symbol of the difficulty that institutions, particularly the criminal justice system in the United States, have in holding powerful men to account for their abuses of women. He has been accused many times over the years, including people who have filed criminal complaints against him in this very court. And this is the first time that he's made it to trial. And it has been a very difficult process of even getting to this point. There have been allegations of prosecutorial misconduct, investigatory misconduct. There have been attacks on the credibility of various witnesses. And people have said they're afraid to come forward because they're afraid of what will happen to them when they're exposed to this kind of public attack and public scrutiny. And I think all of that shows how difficult it is for powerful people to be held to account for this kind of abuse, even after all of the publicity, all of the coverage, all of the evidence that has been introduced into the public sphere.
What makes all this so much more confusing is the civil element as well. There have been a financial settlement, something agreed involving other people who'd made accusations against him.
So there have been a whole series of financial settlements over the years involving Mr. Weinstein.
We know this, do we?
We do. They've come out in the course of the reporting on him. In many cases, he paid settlements to accusers in exchange for essentially gag orders in which they promised not to speak. Some women have now broken those and gone public with accusations. Now there's this recent settlement, which has, I believe, not yet been finalized, but in which a group of accusers would share in about $25 million from Mr. Weinstein. And there are some other civil cases that are pending as well. But it's important to note that those are on completely separate tracks. They will not affect this criminal trial, and this criminal trial will not affect the outcome of those civil proceedings.
And there are continuing, we understand, police investigations in London and in Los Angeles.
That's right.
Right. And of course, we should say, we cannot emphasize enough, he denies all the allegations against him of any non-consensual sexual activity. Amanda, I'm sure we'll come back to you. Thank you very much indeed for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
That's Amanda Taub, who's a writer for The New York Times. You're listening to Woman's Hour. You may well have heard of the term helicopter parents. Have you heard about a snowplow parent? These are people who apparently attempt to clear the way of anything that might obstruct their child's opportunities and chances in life. By removing every obstacle, these people apparently believe that their child's life will be made much easier and glittering success is utterly inevitable. But what does this behaviour do to any child? Snowplow parents are removing the grit of life, apparently, and that can be a real danger. Am I describing you? Is this you? Are you blushing ever so gently? My next guest, Jules, is shaking her head, so I don't think she's a snowplow parent. But could you be accused of being one? This is something we're going to discuss on Wednesday's edition of Woman's Hour. So if it is you, email the programme via the website bbc.co.uk/womanshour. Could you be a human snowplow? So, Jules, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, I know we're in a slightly farcical situation. Jules is not your real name, but that's what I'm going to call you. Back in May of 2018 on this programme, we ran a series of interviews around the subject of being fat. And I should say these conversations were all with listeners who were fat, said they were fat, knew they were fat, owned the term, if you like. Jules, you were 54, I think, when my colleague Anna Miller interviewed you.
That's correct.
So yeah. Things have moved on. And you talked, we're about to hear your interview from a year or so ago. It was quite hard to listen to, even for me. I don't know what you're going to feel like listening to it.
I can't remember it.
Can't you? Okay. No. Well, you're about to be reminded. You had been an average weight, hadn't you?
Yes.
And then something happened.
Yes. I started taking steroids.
Because you had an underactive...
No, because I had Crohn's disease.
Right. Okay. And the steroids had a...
And made me hungry. And just made me eat.
Yeah. And you were eating...
Eating. And then even when the steroids stopped, my appetite had expanded to a degree that was literally, it's like flicking a switch. And it was, you know, I was never full.
Right. Well, we're going to hear the interview from 2018 now, and then we're obviously going to find out what has happened since that conversation. Enna Miller went to see Jules, and she actually took a weight suit with her so she could go out for a walk with her, so she could just understand a little bit about the physical impact of being overweight, something that Jules here in that interview from 2018 describes brilliantly.
I'm just carrying this large lump of flesh around with me. It's like having an alien attached to my body, and I've grown it myself. So if I looked in a mirror now, I would see that my face has kind of disappeared because I've got a lot of chins, and that kind of goes into a very thick neck. Once I get up to, I think it's called the bingo wing parts, I've got hanging fat underneath my arms. And then that comes to the part that I really don't like. At the top of my rib cage, I appear pregnant. I feel like I'm carrying a sort of 7-month pregnancy. It hangs down, and it hangs down over your pubis. I certainly develop sores underneath it. That's really uncomfortable, and you have to obviously be incredibly careful when you're washing and in the shower to make sure everything is dry.
Going from a woman who was slimmer, what's that like, having to even think and deal with that?
It's just part of life of being fat. I am quite careful on how I dress. I wear big pants, you know, gone are the days of sexy underwear and stuff like that. That's long gone. And I'm sad about that, obviously, because you lose your sexuality as you get... Well, I certainly have done. But it's, you know, the overhang. That's the thing that I find really difficult to dress for.
How come you've claimed that word fat? What's the difference between being fat and just... bigger?
Fat is quite a derogatory word. It's thrown at people, you're fat. Bigger makes it sound okay. And probably the people who use the word bigger are probably quite happy in their own skin. I'm not happy to be fat. To me, I'm fat and I don't like it. I've also lost complete interest in clothes. My clothes need before was things that look nice. To go shopping now, it's functional to cover up how I look.
It's interesting that you said that, because when I met you at the station, you turned up and you had the shawl that you've got, yeah. You're wearing now. Yeah. You had that wrapped in front of you. Yeah. And I actually thought, she's not fat.
I know. I've spoken to a very few close friends about this, and they'll say, but you're not fat. I really am.
How does fat make you feel?
Probably the number one thing is embarrassment and shame that I've allowed it to get so far, that I didn't deal with it when it started, because there's no getting away from it, that the only way you get fat is from moving less and eating more. It also makes me feel unwieldy. I can't move my body in the way that I used to move my body. I was a very active person. My husband and I especially love walking in the lakes. I can't do that now. We sail, but I can't sail any longer because I can't move myself around a boat. I can't just jump from one place to the other. I can't step lightly. I've got a very dear friend, has always been fat. She's probably a size 24. She's a bit bigger than me. But the way she moves her body is completely different to mine, whereas I feel I've got this sort of 15-year-old strapped to my front all the time. As I've got fatter, my world has got smaller, because I don't want to be out there. I don't want to be on view. I don't want to be looked at. I am ashamed of being fat.
When you talk about it and talk about all the things that you're thinking... It feels to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, but being fat sounds mentally exhausting.
Being fat is mentally exhausting if you're not happy with it. But I guess more than anything, it's frustrating, because as an intelligent human being, I know what I have to do, but for some reason or other, there is something in my brain which won't let me do it. And in all other aspects of my life, I'm in complete control of it, but for this one, I just can't crack it.
Why can't you do that?
Because there's some comfort in eating. Food provides a sense of pleasure, which creates a small degree of happiness. I've got three children. We have a meal in the evening, which is cooked from scratch. I don't ever have anything in the house like biscuits or crisps or any junk food except for stuff that my daughter would have to go to school.
So if that's the case, that you eat meals from scratch, you don't eat junk food, then without being rude...
How have I got fat?
Yeah.
By moving too little and eating too much. Whilst I eat good food, I eat too much of it. My portion size is big and I eat too fast.
One thing that you said was, being the weight that you are, it's like having a teenager on your back. So I thought I'd come for a walk with you and have a weight suit on just to understand what it's like.
How big is your weight suit?
Well, I've been told it's 3.5 stones.
Okay.
But honestly, carrying it here today, it feels way heavier.
3.5 stones would be just over half of the excess that I'm carrying on.
So will I put it on and then we'll go for that walk?
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
Okay,
but you've got to do the hard stuff. You've got to put your boots on with it on.
Okay.
You've got to do the bending down.
Okay.
Not just put it on and sail out the door. That's not the way it works.
One, two, three, go.
Oh. Okay, that was interesting how I saw you get up then, because you got up like I get up.
When I decided to get up, I had to then think, right, I'm doing it now.
Very interesting what you just said about you're doing it now, because there's a huge amount of that in the day-to-day life of being overweight. The right, okay, come on, 1, 2, 3, go. Because every single thing is an effort. It's horrible. I'm fairly sure, you know, that my family, who I love dearly, there's a lot of eye rolling and like, oh, come on, Mum, get going. You know, don't be lazy. It is lazy because I don't want to do it. But it's not lazy in the sort of conventional sense of I can't be asked, I can't be bothered.
Are you laughing at me?
I am laughing at you. Struggling to put your shoes on. It's actually quite funny to see, because the way you're putting your shoes on is the way that I put my shoes on.
I've got to sit back down now to put my other shoe on.
Okay.
It's beautiful out here.
Thank you. It is. I love it. I live in this absolutely stunning area and I don't walk in it. It's a real shame. Be careful over the cattle grid. There we go. I have a slight advantage because I've had a very recent cortisone injection in one knee. 3 weeks ago, this would not have been possible. When I'm out with my daughter, she'll often say now, do you want my arm, Mummy? I'm 54 years old. I shouldn't be taking someone's arm.
Do you take her arm?
Yes, I do. And I don't really want to fall flat on my face. I'm not obsessive about jumping on scales, though, because it's completely depressing most of the time. But it's just a number at the end of the day.
But it's quite an important number, isn't it?
It is an important number, yeah. It's directly related to my health. And I want that number to be lower. You know, I'm hurtling towards diabetes. I haven't got it at the moment. I have sleep apnea. I have osteoporosis, osteoarthritis. I have incontinence. I have high blood pressure. I've had a TIA, which is a mini stroke. I don't want to die young. But knowing all of that, I still can't lose weight long term sustainably.
You all right?
Yeah, we've just come to the top of the hill. I'm a bit breathless. How are you?
I'm all right.
You sound like you're trying to catch your breath. At this stage, I am looking forward to getting back. I think you can probably hear my breathing is getting harder. My lower back is screaming at me. But it's not really that easy in the country to suddenly sit down in the middle of a field
I can't go for a walk on my own, as I can't get back up again if I fell over. And that's not going to happen. That would be a limit of shame too far for me. Take my arm. For once, I'm the more stable one.
Yeah, we'll walk head home now, yeah.
Yes. It's a beautiful day, though, isn't it?
It's lovely.
Well, that was 2018. Enna and Jules then went back to Jules' house and her husband was there making dinner. They talked separately and then together.
How does being fat affect your relationship with your husband?
That's a very difficult one. Now, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that he loves the bones of me. But he doesn't fancy me. And that's difficult. But I also understand it because I don't fancy me. From an emotional point of view, it's a very difficult thing to cope with. I don't want to take my clothes off in front of anybody else. And certainly not in front of somebody that I used to have a fantastic sex life with. But I don't anymore. And I haven't for a few years.
I can see you're very clearly upset.
No, I'm not upset. No, I find it a very emotional thing to talk about. And in fact, I never talk about it. And we don't talk about it, although we understand each other with it. He's never going to turn around to me and say, I don't fancy you, I'm not going to, you know, we're not going to have sex. That would never happen. Because you don't do that to people you love. But I don't. I don't even know if he wants to. I doubt it very much. But I don't want to. And I don't want to do it. Because I don't love my body.
The thing that you said that sticks in my head was that you said you don't know how to have sex with the body you've got.
No, I don't want to have sex with the body I've got. You know, to have a good sex life, you have to be fairly uninhibited. And I'm about as inhibited as can possibly be. And he has a limited tolerance for the woe is me, oh, I'm fat, it's terrible. And, you know, and he's frustrated by it.
Do you like cooking?
Yeah, love it. I find it relaxing. Takes my mind off things. You can shut out and all the stress that's going on and just chuck something simple together. I need a lid for that. My name's Paul and I'm Georgie's husband.
What has her being fat done to your relationship?
Okay, very close to destroyed it. That's an awful thing to say because it's not about her becoming fat. It's the repercussion. What's the word I'm looking for? The consequences of her becoming the size she has. I find the use of the word fat, it's not an untruth, okay, but just where my head's at. I get defensive, I guess.
Why do you get defensive if she's owning it?
She's my wife.
She wrote into Women's Hour and she said, I'm 54. Until 48, I was a size 8 all my life. She says, now I'm a size 22. I'm 5'7" and 17 stones. She said, my husband is still with me because he loves me, but I'm filled with self-loathing. He doesn't fancy me.
Okay, I'll be brutally honest. No, the physical attraction isn't there. I love her, yes, I do love her. I have been as supportive as I can right the way down the road. It's the loss of self-esteem is the frightening thing about it. It's the fact of not facing the reality, which has led to her almost lashing out to a point where there's not a day go by where there isn't a row. And it's not about the weight thing. It's about an attitude that's in her head and grasping at straws to try and resolve this issue. It's not a size thing. It's how she's dealing with this in her head, which is what's causing the damage.
The problem with a problem like this within a relationship, for me, the writing is on the wall. It doesn't always help to have it read out to you.
So whilst I can say it for myself, it is always harder to hear it from somebody you love. It makes me upset even to talk about it.
I've never called you fat.
No, what did you say?
I've never called you fat.
No, he hasn't called me fat. But it doesn't make it any less true. This is the first time we've really talked about it. 95% of the time, it is literally the elephant in the room.
We could handle things better, but it doesn't. It's such an emotive...
It's too emotive to handle better.
It's emotive subjects, right?
The best thing for our relationship would be for me to be happier, without a doubt.
I want my wife back. But when I mean by I want my wife back, I want my wife back who's got a positive attitude, who is happy, is confident, is comfortable in herself.
I am well aware that the lack of self-esteem are the damaging parts for a relationship, without a doubt.
Some people would say, embrace it, learn to love yourself. Can you learn to embrace it?
I don't want to embrace it, and I don't want to be a bigger woman. The fat and happy maxim is just not for everyone, and it's most definitely not for me. But to do anything about it, to make yourself feel better, you've got to lose weight.
Can I finish you on one note?
What's that?
Okay.
He's quite good at the romantic gestures. He is quite good.
Jules, snorting with derision at herself there. That wasn't me making that noise. So what is that like to listen to that? Because things have changed in your life and your body has changed too, we should say.
It's almost unrecognisable. It feels like a completely different person.
Were you... Because you sound... No one is harder on themselves usually than the individual. You certainly sounded incredibly hard on yourself there. Were you deeply unhappy at the time?
Yes, yeah. Very. I was... It kind of pervaded everything that I did. I felt it just affected everything. It definitely affected my self-esteem at every possible level.
But you were really, really honest. And I heard stuff there about being fat. And I know it's OK for me to use that term in front of you because you say you were fat.
Yep.
That I didn't know before. I hadn't thought about the incontinence element of it. Just the discomfort, the effort just to get about is not something I'd really thought about. And then the stuff like the flab and the fact that you have to be careful cleaning under it and all this. I should say on Twitter, people are commending you again for your honesty. What happened after that interview?
Well, during that period, I had already begun to jump through the huge amount of hoops required to go for bariatric surgery with the National Health. National Health will allow bariatric surgery if you have a BMI of 35 or more and a comorbidity such as sleep apnea or severe arthritis or diabetes. And these things are really very common with people who are obese. So people do qualify for it. It's never offered.
No. OK, well, we can get on to that in a moment. We should say that your weight, you said during that interview, your weight was about 17 stone. In fact, it went up to about 19.
It went up to 19.2.
And so when you went to your GP, presumably,
yes.
What happened?
Well, I've obviously been to my GP a number of times. I'm fat and miserable. What can I do? I tried various, potions and pills. There have been Zenical. I don't know if that's a trade name or a proprietary name. It's like a fat binder. I've tried that. That was really grim. And I won't go into the details of it, but it's really not a pleasant experience.
Well, it wasn't for you anyway.
It wasn't for me.
And we should say everything you say is your story, your personal view. You're not here to offer advice to anybody.
Not at all.
This is about you.
Yeah. There are a lot of people out there. I've got a very close friend out there who are clinically obese and they have absolutely no problem with it at all. They're quite happy where they are and they have no intention of changing it. It just wasn't for me.
So you were eventually offered a gastric sleeve.
When I say offered, I asked for, I looked at what the criteria were, I saw that I qualified. I had a BMI at the time of 41 and I was able to get onto a gastric sleeve, or a bariatric programme at St Richard's Hospital in Chichester, and I started the process.
How long does it all take?
It takes a year. For me, it took a year. So there's a year of preparation where you, some of it may seem really, I don't know, slightly patronising. You know, they teach you what a food label is. You know, but that for some people that is needed. Some people don't actually know what the food labels mean. So I didn't really feel I needed that. My issue wasn't really the content of my food intake. I'm very much a family that cooks. We're not very big instant food eaters. I enjoy cooking. My issue was quantity and portion size. So for me, that was what that did. So we went through the process, the 1 year process of various different workshops, group sessions about, you know, why we ate, very valuable sort of pre-op support in that respect. And then conversation with a surgeon about the best op for you. Bands are not very popular anymore. The NHS doesn't like to do them. It's been too much problem with them.
Well, and I'm sure some people would say they had a gastric band and it was fine.
Some have been fine, but the NHS in general now prefers that the gold standard is the gastric bypass. I was offered a gastric sleeve because my issue was quantity rather than quality.
And the result of your gastric sleeve is that your stomach is now tiny.
Tiny. It's now about 85 to 90% smaller than it was.
What was the recovery from that operation like?
2 days.
You were only in hospital for two days?
I was in hospital for 2 days.
And when did you start to feel different, better?
You start, when you come out of hospital, you're very much on sort of pure, little tiny bits of pureed food. So my husband was phenomenal at that point. You know, he just pureed, you know, most amazing array of pureed dishes of about 2 or 3 spoonfuls. So I had a very varied diet, which was great. And that went on for about a month. And then slowly introduce, you know, a bit of toast or a bit of, you know, scrambled egg.
But you weren't hungry?
No.
And you're still not?
No.
So how much weight has disappeared?
I've lost 7 stone 2.
And do you... Well, I don't know because I didn't see you when you were 19 stone. Do you feel utterly different?
It is... There's barely words to say how different I feel. I can just move. Now I can move. I felt like I was almost wearing a suit of armour before, and I had to sort of, I know, manipulate my limbs around to sort of make them do what I wanted to do, carrying all the weight, and now I don't even have to think about it.
And we should say you are a person with... We can't go into details of what you do for a living, but it's extremely important and it's challenging. And you are now better able to do it, would you say?
I can now do all the... I'd kind of been a bit desk-based over the last few years as I'd got bigger, and I'm now a full member of our team.
And were you judged? Did you feel judged every day of your life for being a fat woman?
I judge mostly myself. I felt judged in some ways by being sidelined. The type of things that I would have been asked to do before, I was no longer asked to do because I couldn't do them. And so, of course, people didn't ask me. I didn't want to put myself out there. I have a lot of opportunity within my work for presentation and standing up in front of people. I didn't want to do that. So I kind of, you know, everything. I didn't want to go out very much into new places. Certainly didn't want to go places where I'd see people who had known me before I was fat, because I could see that look in their eyes, because I put on such a huge amount of weight really fast.
Yeah.
You can actually, there's no way taking it away when people look at you and you can just see they're going, God, yeah. Wow.
Your relationship with your husband, I'm sure it was never without challenges, what relationship is, but he does come across in that interview, and I know he has been extremely supportive. You've said so this morning, but you are now separated.
We are. My husband was really worried about the operation. He was he was really concerned. He was concerned about my health and above everything else. I think there's also to a certain extent, you know, don't put yourself through this. Diet and exercise will do it. I know that he didn't do anything like the amount of research that I did into it before he even went down this road. So I knew that what I was doing was right for me. We have separated. We are very much still together. Self-loathing in a relationship causes a lot of damage. But also newfound confidence also makes differences. And it's really the two of us negotiating our pathway down that way. And hopefully we'll get there.
Well, thank you very much for coming on live this morning and just for your honesty, which I know people are finding very, very impressive. So, Jules, thank you. Best of luck with everything. And just to reiterate, as Jules is very keen to say, this is not about her advice or telling people they've got to lose weight or anything like it. It's just what she's done because it was right for her. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Thanks, Jane.
Thank you very much and take care. And on Wednesday, Melissa, another of the voices you heard back in 2018, will be on the programme talking to Jenny about how she feels now about her body. So thanks to everybody for taking part in these conversations. Hugely important, I know. Thank you very much. Now, we're going to talk about mindfulness for parents. Izzy Judd is here. She's written a book called Mindfulness for Mums. Izzy will be known to people via Instagram and via your work with Escala. And yes, because you're married to Harry Judd. But it's good to see you. Welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me. It's lovely to be back.
And Sean Warriner is here, consultant midwife at Oxford University Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust. You work at the Oxford Mindfulness Centre, Sean. And it says on your website that your mission is to reduce suffering, promote resilience and realise human potential across the lifespan through mindfulness. So just for anyone who doesn't know, a really quick definition. What is mindfulness?
Mindfulness is present moment awareness in its most simple form. We spend a lot of our time in what's described within mindfulness literature as automatic pilot. So we drift off into the past or into the future. And, you know, reflection is a useful thing for us to be doing, but that can easily tip into rumination of what should have happened, what could have happened, or the if onlys. And future planning, we all need to future plan and think about what we're going to do. But again, that can easily tip into overthinking and catastrophizing what may or may not happen. So it's that ability to come back to this present moment now and say, well, how are things for me in this moment? Acknowledge that. And doing that with a sense of non-judgment and kindness and compassion towards yourself, which can be really difficult for many of us, as, you know, as we were hearing from Jules, you know, the idea of judging yourself, the sort of lack of kindness we can apply to ourselves is really difficult for many people.
So, Izzy, tell me how you came to mindfulness. Is it something, I know you had anxiety as a child, and for, I should say, understandable reasons, your brother had had a terrible accident, it impacted hugely on you and the rest of the family. Have you always used mindfulness?
Mindfulness really came into my life when I read a fascinating book called Calming Your Anxious Mind. And anxiety is something I've always had. It's something as a child I knew I had, but I didn't know it had a name. And any time in my life I've gone through great change or period of feeling out of control, and of course becoming a mother, there is no greater time than feeling like you are out of control. I stopped practicing mindfulness because A, I felt I didn't know if when I had the time, and B, we tend to put our children's needs ahead of our own well-being as a mother. And I realised the impact it was having on my anxiety by not practising. And for me, Mindfulness for Mums is a collection of really simple exercises mums can incorporate into their day. And as these little moments build up, your overall sense of well-being is improved.
Right, your children are nearly four, we need to make that clear, and two.
That's correct.
How can you find time in a day at home with two small children to practise any of these mindfulness techniques?
So you can practise mindfulness with your children. They can.
Can you?
Yes. So whether they choose to sit and join in or cause chaos, that's up, you know, that is just whatever the day might bring. But for example, with Lola, we do breathing exercise together and Kit starting to join in. So we lie down, we choose a teddy bear, she chooses one for me, one for her. We place it on our tummies and we breathe in and out. We watch the teddy rising and falling, and it's just getting her used to connecting herself with her breath, because as children we are very naturally mindful, and as adults we forget how to be mindful. We forget to think about our breath. Often a whole day's gone by and we haven't even thought about it, and we're so in our heads, and the busyness of life as a mother, the feeling of being overwhelmed, the emotions you go through from frustration, your patience is being tested. So finding moments in the day, for example, a mindful pause, you're waiting for the kettle to boil and the children want their breakfast in the morning. You're standing there, ground your feet, take a deep breath in for four.
Can I stop you?
Yes.
Ground your feet. Do you mean suddenly making yourself aware of the fact that your feet are touching the
floor?
Yeah,
because we're so in our heads and with all the to-do list is spinning round, we're almost, I have moments, this is just my experience, where I feel like I'm floating, that I can't get centred as mum. I'm juggling my work, I'm juggling my family life, I'm the busyness of everything. To just go, right, I am here. Today, everything is okay. The children are waiting for their breakfast. This is my day ahead. I'm going to make myself a cup of tea. I'm going to just take a moment. I'm going to take a deep breath. I'm going to just say a positive affirmation. No, all is well. And it just...
But then you hear the radio news and all is not well. I'll put it to you.
That's it. But to be present, to be able to, as somebody that has had anxiety, when I create stories, I catastrophise, and especially with children, it doubles worrying about what might happen to them.
Oh, I do get that. Yeah. I'm absolutely on that with you. Sian, apparently mindfulness can help during labour. Now, I had cesarean, so I've never had I don't know about labour, I'll be absolutely honest with you. Can it really? Because I suspect some of our listeners will go, not on your Nelly. But tell me.
And I'm sure. And everybody has an individual experience of mindfulness. And we teach the 4-week course that we teach in Oxford, which is an antenatal mindfulness course. It combines preparation for pregnancy and labour and childbirth into the transition to parenthood. So we have the skills around what's needed for pregnancy and birth interwoven with mindfulness skills. And we make no assumptions about how women are going to be giving birth. The women who come to that may well be having cesarean sections. In fact, many, many of them do. And we don't know what's going to happen with that labour. So
but
it's
the
done
pain,
in a very judgmental, non-judgmental way. Pain, yeah, I mean, we recognise pain. Labour is not without pain, and you have to be open and honest about that. But it's the attitude that we bring to that that can make a big difference. And for many people, fear, you know, fear of the unknown, fear of loss of control, fear of something that, yeah, they don't know what's coming, is a big issue for them. We have as you were saying, it's about having that control over your life a lot of the time, and then suddenly finding that's being taken away from you. So what we begin to do within the 4-week course that we run is provide those very simple exercises that Lizzie was talking about around how to ground yourself, how to come back to that sense of being centered but of being calm, knowing that each of these moments is going to pass. So not being in the middle of the labour thinking, oh my goodness, that was a dreadful, dreadful contraction and there's another one about to come and I don't know what I'm going to do. But coming back to this moment right now and perhaps in between and saying, well, it's okay now. You know, in this moment, I'm all right.
I see. So own the gaps between the pain.
Absolutely.
And relish them. OK.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's Sian Warriner, who's a consultant midwife in Oxford. And she also, we should say, works at the Oxford Mindfulness Centre. And our thanks to Izzy Judd as well, who's written this book called Mindfulness for Mums. And there's an extract from her book, actually, which I didn't get the chance to read out. But I'll do it now because I do think this is really helpful if you've just had a baby or just about to. I think Izzy rather brilliantly expresses what it's like to be particularly a first-time mother. She says, from the day Lola arrived, I felt vulnerable. In my arms was a baby I knew I loved completely, and yet I didn't know her at all. I didn't know how she liked to be held. I was confused about when and how to feed her. I didn't know how to breastfeed. I didn't know how to swaddle, or even if she liked being swaddled. I didn't know how to wash or dress her without her crying, and I'd never changed a nappy. I remember thinking, I was no good at this already, and it quickly became all about survival and simply getting to the end of the day. I think anyone who's been there will understand exactly how Izzy feels. And the good news is, I think it really helps to acknowledge that feeling, and it does get easier. certainly you have to dig in, I think it's fair to say, in the early weeks and months, as many people will understand. But my thanks to Izzy for taking part in the programme today. And clearly she really does find that mindfulness helps her and her family. And we've had some emails on this subject of mindfulness as well. This is Susan. I remember practicing mindfulness with my son before I'd even heard the term. Just sitting on the floor with him, the two of us playing with his toys, engrossed together in the moment. I remember the pleasure and the quiet concentration, she says. And this from another listener. Don't use my name, she says. Fair enough. Just wanted to share that I've just finished an 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction course, and I can attest to its life-changing, life-enhancing powers. I've got a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old and a partner, both on the autistic spectrum. Juggling my own anxieties and black dog tendencies, mindfulness has made my body finally feel like a friendly, safe place to be, even when life around me feels chaotic and out of control. It's almost beyond words the unquantifiable way that mindfulness practice changes the way I confront life and its challenges, as though there is space where there wasn't any before, and grey area options and choices that my previously anxious mind couldn't see beforehand. I highly recommend it to anybody in any life situation. Wow, I mean, that listener certainly feels that it's had a very positive impact on her. Now, being fat, which is the subject that our listener Jules was on the programme to talk about, a lot of people basically just wanted to say that they heard her and they felt for her and they really recognise a lot of what she had to say. This listener says, I am a fat lady. I had numerous strokes and lots of heavy-duty steroids to stop my brain swelling. The result, I'm fat and alive rather than a slender corpse. As exercise is difficult, I swim when I can, and yes, I cook from scratch. I was a trained ballet teacher, so I really miss exercise. But I still prefer being alive than the alternative, and I refuse to be made to feel guilty for my weight. Another listener, this is like listening to myself. I haven't bought any clothes for years, just clothes I can get into. It is mentally exhausting. Jules is right. I think about how fat I am almost constantly. Everything is centred around my weight, how I look, how I can't do things because I'm too heavy, and how embarrassing I must be for my children. Thank you for such an honest contribution. Another listener says, I'm 5'4" and I'm a size 20. I look great. I am more than happy with this. I don't put weight on, and sometimes I lose some, but not too much, I hope, or I'll need new clothes. My size isn't important to me, as I've got so much to do every day and a lot of responsibility. It has never occurred to me that I might not be attractive. In fact, I feel attractive, and my partner finds me so, as do other people. I'm in my 60s and far from invisible, which is the other rubbish that women spout. I have so many things going on in my life that it would be a long time before I started to worry about whether I was a size 14 or not. There you go. You do get, there are plenty of people entirely happy with their lot, fat or not, and you will hear some of those voices later this week on the programme. Email from Ian, who says, my mother died on Saturday morning, having been through 35 years of hell as a fat person, suffering all the issues discussed, but without the support of a partner. It has been dreadful for years. Ian, I'm so sorry to hear about that. And indeed about the loss of your mum. But thank you for emailing the programme. That just sounds awful, doesn't it? I'm sorry, Ian. And Annie, very intense and emotional story from Jules this morning. Her self-assessment and her honesty were inspiring. Wishing her love and luck for the future. And a listener says on email, I'm listening to Jules sobbing my heart out. It's touched me in places I had buried. My story is that I was an overweight baby, an overweight child, an overweight teenager. Put on amphetamines to lose weight by a GP back in the 60s. As an adult, I yo-yo dieted, losing over 4 stone repeatedly and then putting it back on again. 4 pregnancies, type 2 diabetes, all the medication that goes with that. Finally, the luck to find, accidentally, a GP with an interest in diabetes who put me onto a low-carb way of life. I'm off beige carbs now for nearly 2 years and off medication. I still hate myself and identify as being big, and I'm nearly 70. But well done to Jules, and my thanks for telling her story. And again, we wish that listener the very best of luck. But as I say, different experiences coming up later in the week. Other voices whose bodies haven't necessarily changed, but whose attitudes have. So that's later this week on the programme. Tomorrow, really looking forward to talking to Professor Helen Taylor, who's written a book called Why Women Read Fiction. It's that simple, but as you'll realise, of course, why women read and what they read isn't simple at all. So we'll discuss all that on Woman's Hour tomorrow.
Henry Akeley disappeared from his home on the edge of Rendlesham Forest somewhere around the end of June 2019.
They come every night now. The police don't believe me. Now, please, I just need you to get in touch.
What we uncovered is a mystery that has sent us deep into England's past. To an area steeped in witchcraft, the occult, secret government operations.
Now we have multiple sightings of five lights with a similar shape pattern.
And something that might indeed be altogether otherworldly. This is The Whisperer in Darkness.
Available now on BBC Sounds.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.